Welcome to Empowering Homeschool Conversations. This is a weekly broadcast put on by SPED Homeschool, which is a nonprofit that empowers families to teach children with specialized educational needs at home. And we are starting off a new year with a new monthly theme, which we do a monthly theme every month. And this month we're focusing on teaching methodologies. And tonight I'm super excited because we're gonna be talking about unschooling. It's something that I told our guest kind of creeped up on me, and I'm so glad that it did. And so tonight we have the privilege of having Dr. Peter Gray with us. And I just wanna welcome you, Peter, and thank you for just taking time to share with our audience and just the wealth of information you have to share. And I know we can't even begin to cover it in an hour, but I'm excited that you're able to share a little bit and just encourage our audience to maybe a teaching methodology that they have been scared of or didn't think might work for their child. So thanks for joining us tonight.
Very happy to be here.
Yeah. Just a second, I gotta pull that off. So I'm just going to read a quick introduction, and then also I want to remind our audience, if you're watching, that you can interact with us live. And if you have comments or questions, you can put those in the feed either on YouTube or on Facebook, and we'll see those and be able to incorporate those into our conversation. So Dr. Peter Gray is a research professor of psychology at Boston College who has conducted and published research in neuroendocrinology, developmental psychology, anthropology, and education. His recent research focuses on the roles in human evolution and how children educate themselves through play and exploration when they are free to do so. He's expanded on these in his book, Free to Learn, which is an awesome book. I'd have to highly recommend it. His research includes surveys of grown unschoolers and graduates of a school designed for self-directed education. He also authors a regular blog called Freedom to Learn for Psychology Today magazine. His research findings have led him to become an advocate for self-directed education, and he's a founding member and president of the Alliance for Self-Directed Education. So much, and it's been a lifelong dedication of yours, and I'm just excited that you're able to share some of your wisdom with us tonight. So as we kind of get started, what is some, I guess you have probably lots of it, but just to kind of touch the tip of the iceberg on research-based information on learning and social development of children versus what happens in more of a structured school environment. So what are the differences? And
yeah, how would you go with that? Well, you know, I'm really interested in the question of how children naturally learn. And the ways that children naturally learn are nothing like what we try to do in school. And in fact, yes. Schools actively repress the natural ways that children learn. I mean, children are designed to learn by exploring. You know, they're just naturally curious about the world around them. Mm-hmm. They're designed to learn by playing. They play, curiosity. You know, in one way to think about it is there's sort of two parts to education, acquiring knowledge and acquiring skills. Yeah. Curiosity is the drive for knowledge. Children want to know what's going on around them. They want to understand it. They're constantly, you know, as soon as a baby can move, you've got to baby-proof your house because the baby wants to get into everything, right? Yeah. Why does the baby want to get into everything? Not to be naughty, but to understand it, to explore it, to figure it out. You can't stop children from learning, you know, unless you lock them away in a closet. And so that's curiosity. And play, children play, if they have ample time to play, they play at all the basic skills that human beings have to learn. So curiosity is how you acquire knowledge. Play is how you acquire skills. Mm. Well, of course, in school, curiosity cannot be the motive for learning because you've got 20 or 30 kids in a class. There's no possible way they're all going to be curious about the same thing at the same time. And the teacher has to be sure they're doing the same thing. And And so what you have in the classroom is not the questions of the kids that matter. And so the kids learn their questions don't count. What counts is the questions of the curriculum, which 9 times out of 10, even the teacher isn't all that interested in. This is just the question of the curriculum. And so children learn not to be curious. So we drive that natural tendency out of children in our schools. Similarly, if play occurs at all at school, it's recess. It's a break from learning. It's not regarded as learning. It's something that there's kind of the belief, kids need a little break from learning before they get back to the serious task of sitting in their seats and learning. So so the difference is stark. And I don't think it's an accident that the difference is so stark, because schools were really never developed for the purpose that we would like them to serve today, that most people would like them to serve today. Schools were really, the schools that we have today really began, centuries, really began as in the 17th century. It goes really way back, the first kinds of schools that looked like schools today. And they were religious schools, that Protestant religious schools, and the purpose of them was to teach obedience and to indoctrinate children in, at that time, in biblical doctrine. So that's the kind of school you would set up if that's your purpose, to teach obedience and to indoctrinate children in something that you believe is truth with a capital T. And then schools got started, and they were ultimately taken over by states, by governments, where now the goal became not the doctrine of religion, but the doctrine of the state. It was sort of to teach nationalist beliefs. And then with time, we've sort of expanded our view. We no longer think of schools as to indoctrinate children either in religion or in nationalist beliefs, although we still do a little bit of that. But we have all these other agendas, but we haven't changed the way we do school. We still do it in the same way, where, the teacher tells you information, presents information, and you have to feed it back. Yeah. And if you think about it, the only way that you can fail in our standard schools is by not doing what you're told to do. And the only way you can pass is by, at least most of the time, doing what you're told to do.
Right.
And so it's still the case that the primary lesson is obedience, to authority. Mm-hmm. Do what you're told to do and you will pass. No matter how boring it is, no matter whether it's going to last with you or not, no matter whether you already know it or not, no matter whether it's just a total waste of time for you, you've got to learn to do what you're told to do. And so most people who go into teaching today don't think that their purpose in teaching is to teach obedience and indoctrinate children. They talk about, I want children to be curious, I want them to love learning, I want them to be critical thinkers, I want all of this and that. But if that were really the purpose of schools, schools would look nothing like what they look like today. So unfortunately, what happens is teachers come in with, young teachers may come in with very ideal ideas of what they want to do, but there they are. They're faced with 30 kids. Mm-hmm. The primary thing they have to do is keep order, or they'll get fired if they don't keep order. Mm-hmm. They've got to make sure the kids pass certain tests. No way can they promote curiosity. No way can they allow the kids to play in their own natural ways. And this is more true today than it was even in the past, because we've become more insistent about testing. We've developed a stronger hierarchical control. It used to be the teachers had more authority in the classroom and they could loosen up and they could do fun things. And now many of those teachers who used to do that are quitting because they're finding they can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. They're being directed that you've got to spend time preparing these kids for these standardized exams. So that's standard education, and that's nothing like the way children naturally learn. And in fact, it suppresses the way children naturally learn. So what I've been interested in is, well, what would happen if we didn't do that? If instead of that, we let kids learn in their natural ways. And we adults simply provided the kind of environment and opportunities that allows children to do that. What would happen if you did that? Well, it turns out that there have been this idea has been around for quite a long time. There are schools that have been operating for many years. Sudbury Valley has been operating for over 50 years, which is where I did my first research with this principle. This is a place for self-directed education where children are playing and exploring and following their own interests and socializing with one another and in the process becoming educated. And then, so I did a study many years ago of the graduates of that school. And then there are also this growing number of unschoolers, as you said in the introduction. So homeschoolers who are saying, well, instead of trying to do school at home, instead of, you know, giving my kids the same kind of curriculum, which my kids apparently aren't very interested in, why don't I let them do what they're interested in, and instead of fighting with them to make them do this other stuff, why don't I go with them and say, okay, this is what you're interested in, you know, if I can be of any help, let me know. that's sort of what unschooling is. And so well, it turns out there are quite a lot of unschoolers in this country. I mean, proportion-wise, it's small, but it's still, you know, I figured out that that there's something, actually, there's a big increase now in homeschoolers and in unschoolers because of COVID. But even before COVID, it was something between 3% and 5% of American school children are being homeschooled. And of those, based on government data, I figure that about 20% of those, so it's something like 1%, something roughly around 1% of children in the United States are being unschooled. That's a small percentage, but that's a huge number. And if you,
Right, and you also talk about it as relaxed homeschooling, which I think some people are a little more welcoming.
There are a lot of people who are really doing unschooling, but they don't want to call it that. You know, that sounds to them like they're being neglectful, or they might think other people are thinking they're being neglectful. So there's a range of it. I think the majority of homeschoolers they're not doing, except in maybe a very few cases, they're not doing as much school like school as the kids would be having if they were going to a typical standard school. So no matter how you're doing homeschooling, there's more unschooling going on. There's more time for children to do their own things, to play, to explore, to follow their own interests. And even when you're supposedly doing the curriculum, you know, it's very hard if you're a parent, and this is your child, to just override your child's interest. You at least try to sort of focus it around your child's interest so that the child becomes more engaged in it, and the child wants to do this because you're figuring out some way, all right, we've got to do geography or whatever it is you've got to do because you're thinking you're doing school. So let's at least talk about the geography and see if there's some aspect of geography that you might be interested in, you know, and maybe this is just, you know, maybe you've already got an interest in geography, and maybe it comes from a computer game you're playing, and maybe it's this or that, you know, but so it can be focused more on the child's own interests. It's definitely more child-centered. That's not totally unschooling when the parent is involved that way, but it's in the direction of it compared to at school.
Well, so that's the basic difference. The basic difference is that it's like if you dabble in just a little bit, that the water feels more comfortable to then take the next step.
I think that's right.
Towards that unschooling.
That's right. I did a study along with Gina Riley, is a colleague who's at Hunter College, and I did a study of unschooling families where we surveyed the parents. There were 323 parents, if I remember right, in that who responded to our survey, mostly moms, of course. And we asked them, among other things, the trajectory that led them to unschooling. And relatively few of them started with unschooling. Some of them started with homeschooling, and then they realized that not only were their kids bored with the with the curriculum that they were trying to teach, but they were bored with it. And so it sort of devolved. And then they learned, well, then so they let the kids do more and more of their own thing. And then they learned, oh, there's a term for this. It's called unschooling. And then they felt a little better about it. We're not just being neglectful here. We're doing unschooling. And so that was kind of the one route. You probably even more common was to actually start off at least with your first child in a typical school, and that didn't work out. And so then so then you take the child out for homeschooling, and that doesn't work out. Then you try unschooling, and lo and behold, the child is happy. The child's eyes brighten up again. The child seems to be learning. And then the study, another study that Gina Riley and I did was of the graduate, former, you know, people who grew up unschooled. We identified 75 grown unschoolers and asked them about their experiences when they were being unschooled, asked them about how they were, did they go on to higher education or not? And if they did, how did they get in without having done any school before, right? How did they survive it once they got in? And for those who didn't go on, why didn't they? Couldn't they? Is it possible, you know, couldn't you do it or didn't you want to do it? And if you didn't want to do it, why didn't you want to do it? We asked them about their careers. And what we basically found is that they can go, they don't seem to have any problem going on to higher education if they want to do it. If they're going into a career that requires it, they go on and they figure out how what they have to do to get into the college they want to get into. You know, they figure it out. They haven't taken any of the required courses, right? But they say, but in some sense, this is kind of refreshing to the administrator, at least in some colleges, you know, you're looking at all these students that, you know, they've all got A's on their transcripts. They've all done all the things you're supposed to do to get into college, especially if you're at an elite college. Now here's somebody who says, "Oh, I don't have any transcript. I haven't taken any courses." You know, but here's what I've done, and here's why I want to go to your college. And and you know, that's kind of interesting. This person is different, and
and a lot of the colleges now are asking for portfolios.
Yeah, they're asking for portfolios, and the unschoolers are generally very good at portfolios, and they're also generally very good at interviews. They typically can get an interview because you know this is one way to get to know them, and if where you don't have the typical things, and if it's a school that requires the SAT or the ACT. The kids prepare for it and they do fine on it. It doesn't take a heck of a lot of work to prepare for it. They figure out a way even kids who are going through the regular school, they take the SAT, they study the SAT prep book, and that's how they learn to do it. And so these kids do the same thing, and maybe they have to study a little bit of math to bring themselves up to the point where they can do it, but it doesn't take years and years and hours and tears of doing it. You're 15, 16, 17 years old, and you want to do it.
The rest of them. So, yes.
so that's what we found regarding higher education. What we found regarding careers was interesting. That at least about half of them, I should say, we could see a very direct relationship between what they told us they were doing as a child, what they were passionate about playing at, and what their career was today. So it's not uncommon in self-directed education, and whether it's at a democratic school like the Sudbury Valley School or whether it's in unschooling, for children to play at a lot of different things, and they get then at some point, some of them, not everyone, but some of them develop a real passionate interest, and they really focus on that, and they become good at it. And some of them actually start making money at it while they're still kids. This is not too uncommon, becoming, I think, even more and more common today with the internet, and you can be an entrepreneur, you can start selling your stuff, you could start, and they've, in some sense, then got a head start on their career, and we found about 50% of that 75, about half of them were in careers that they had passionate interests in that were direct extensions of what they had done what they had been doing in play as children.
So they're not the ones that graduate from college and go, I still don't
and
know
often
what
those are not the ones
do.
Who graduate from the college. Most often
right,
they're
exactly.
not. But some of them are because they what they wanted to do it requires college
it.
Sort of as a license. But I'll mm-hmm. you know, just give you just to give you an example or two. So one of the
yeah.
one of these young adults, he was about 20 or 21 when we did the study. And he was an assistant movie producer in Hollywood, assistant to a movie producer in Hollywood. His dream is to become a movie producer. Well, he's a kid like a lot of kids today who was making YouTubes, you know,
right, yeah.
and who got good at it. And he, you know, and he was attracting an audience. And he and he discovered at one point, I believe he was living in Chicago, and he discovered at one point that his major movie was going to be made in his city. And he volunteered to help. And
yeah.
so he went out and he helped. He was probably about 16. And the person he was helping was so impressed with him that they invited him back to Hollywood at a good salary
wow.
while he's still a teenager.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, that's just one example.
Mm-hmm.
Take another example. There was one of the graduates was, well, he described his interests as a child as, he had three interests. One was nature, hiking. He spent as much time as he could out in the woods hiking.
Uh-huh.
A second interest was photography, and he got really interested in photography. And by the age of 15, he said he was already selling some photographs.
Wow.
But then also around age 15, he got interested in hang gliding. So,
wow.
And from hang gliding, he got interested in flying fixed wing aircrafts.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess he was making enough money from his photography that he could afford to take lessons.
That's
and now his career is a... as an aerial nature photographer, combines
wow.
all three of his interests.
Yeah.
And I happened to, I found his website. It's actually beautiful stuff that he does. So you know, those are just two examples. Maybe those are the two most exotic examples, but I could go through many, many other examples where
right.
kids, you know, jobs that you would never think of. If you had just
exactly.
been doing school, you know, you'd think, yeah, what else is there to do? There's, you know, if I'm aiming for a high status job, I guess I want to be a doctor or I want to be a lawyer.
Right.
Or be,
yeah.
But who would think of being an aerial nature photographer, right?
Right.
Or,
exactly.
or, you know, so that's, so you have time to learn what you like to do. And you have time to become good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And
exactly.
it turns out that knowing what you want to do and being good at it is actually a lot more important as a career qualification than what
mm-hmm.
degree you have.
Yes.
It's not the case that all employers understand that yet, but a growing
mm-hmm.
number are learning to understand that.
Right, yeah. And... yeah, and that self-confidence that comes with it. I think, you know, our education system, so especially with kids that struggle, which is what our nonprofit helps parents to teach kids that struggle with the typical academics, you know, all we want to focus is on, and this is what you do bad, you know, and where unschooling just unlocks that, this is what you do good, and you could do it all day.
Right.
And work on that. I know my daughter at 16, she just won a design contest. She's been designing and doing drawing, but also fashion. And she designed a pair of shoes that are now being produced in Holland. And they're going to be mass produced.
Wow.
But it's something that she wants to go into fashion design. And what an
Great.
Awesome thing to add to her portfolio.
Yes, indeed. Yeah.
But you just never know unless you give them that time. Because they can't
right.
develop those skills overnight or in between all these classes. That
right. Yeah. I mean, we're the, in this day and age, more so than ever in the past, we're keeping kids so busy with between school and homework and all those after school
mm-hmm.
activities, adult directed after school activities that they tend to be put into. They really don't have time to develop hobbies and figure out what they really love to do.
Yeah.
Interestingly, with COVID, some kids are having time. And so
yes.
I'm hearing from parents who are discovering that, hey, you know, my kid is not wasting time home from school. My kid has actually gotten into this and that, and I'm thinking of not sending my kid back to school. I'm seeing things in my child that I didn't realize were there. And so unfortunately, the COVID prevents them from going out and playing with friends, at least in close distance, but it doesn't, but it ha gives them the gift of time. And you know, there were all these dire fears about how children were going to suffer as a result of COVID. So far, the studies that have been done, despite what you read in the paper, the actual studies that have been done show that that all in all, children are doing better psychologically since COVID than before. And why? It's because their schedule has slowed down. They don't have the stress of school. School is the number one stress for kids. People don't recognize that, but I've published data that shows that, not my own research, but other people's research, that shows that the rate of emotional breakdowns, the rate of psychological break, the rate of depression, anxiety, and even of suicide is much higher during the school year than it is when kids are off from school in the summer. And I know of at least one state's data, preliminary data, showing that the rate of suicide among school-age kids has dropped during the COVID period when they're not in school. Everybody's afraid of all the psychological damage of this, and I don't want to. I don't want to. I don't want to be too rosy about this. I mean, clearly, many people are suffering from COVID, and many kids are too. And many kids are suffering from being at home and families that don't get along very well with one another, and so on and so forth. Absolutely, I don't want to understate that. But we did a study through the Let Grow organization across social classes, a large-scale study. It's published as one of my blog posts on my Psychology Today blog. Anybody who's interested can look it up. But we surveyed a large number of families, and what we found across race, across social class, across geography, we found that the kids were, and the parents were reporting the kids to be less anxious and reporting them to do well. And parents were reporting that they were having far less conflicts with their children than they had when the kids were in school. And a lot of people, they hear that, that's surprising to them because they think, well, you know, if your kids are home all day and you're home all day, isn't that going to create conflicts? And I'm sure it does create some conflicts, but I think that most of the conflicts that parents have with kids are about school.
Yeah,
It
just
has,
getting
you
their
got to
schoolwork
get the
done.
kid up in the morning. Kids are sleep deprived. They're not designed to get up at 7 in the morning to get ready for
No.
the bus, or 6 in the morning for some kids. They're just not, especially teenagers are.
Yeah, no.
So you got to
We
get them
didn't
out
start school till
of
after noon when my kids were teenagers.
You got to get them out of bed. You got to, and then when they're home, you got to nag them to do their homework. You've got to make sure, because you as the parent are held responsible if the kids don't do their homework in
Yeah,
today's
it's so
world.
much
You get
pressure.
blamed by the teachers. You get called in, you're sitting in that little seat and the teacher's scolding you, you
Yes.
know, in a, not in the same nasty way that they might scold your kid, but they're still clearly blaming you for the fact that your kid
They
is
may
not
find
doing the
me too,
homework. And so then you've got to, so of course there are conflicts between kids and parents. And a lot of parents were reporting, oh, my child is so well rested, and it has, and part of it is that they're just getting enough sleep now. So,
Right,
you know, that
exactly.
was one of the things that we learned in the study. This would be true for homeschooling of any kind too, that you don't have to go on a certain schedule. You can
No, yes.
the kids can sleep on their own biological rhythm, and they can get enough sleep that way, and they are better people as a result of that.
Exactly. Oh, that's so true. Yeah, I think what the negative reports we're seeing from the schools is that kids aren't meeting those standardized test standards, and they're all falling behind as this average that we're
Right.
all the schools achieve for,
Right.
which when you're unschooling or you're homeschooling, you don't do
You
that.
don't worry about that. And I think that it would be good if, for those people who do have kids in school, if they could realize this is not really such a big problem. And one of the reasons I know it's not such a big problem is I've seen this over and over and over again. you will find an unschooled kid or a kid going to Sudbury Valley, and at some point they decide for whatever reason that they want to go to a regular school. Mm-hmm. And there's often good reasons. They just want to try it out. Their friends are there. They think they might be missing something. Mm-hmm. They want to be in high school and have the prom, and this is part of the cultural thing. So they decide to go to school. And here they haven't taken any of the previous courses at all. They've never taken a standardized test.
Right.
And yet they go to school and they go right into what grade they would be in and they do fine. Mm-hmm. They catch right up. You know, it's not like you're falling. I think there's two reasons that they catch up. One is that the truth of the matter is everybody in school forgets most of that stuff anyway.
Exactly.
Right?
You're always relearning.
You're just learning it for the test, and so you forget it. It's not like there's this big accumulation of knowledge over time, and third grade builds on first grade and on second grade, and then it doesn't build that way. You know, and this is also, I'm sure, why kids can go on to college who haven't taken any courses before. Mm-hmm. The college professors don't assume that you remember anything from high school. They start, you know, they're teaching at a faster and more sophisticated level and a more interesting level, perhaps, but they're not assuming that you are coming in with knowledge of the subject from high school. They're assuming that they've got to start from scratch. And they're also, to be honest, they're arrogant enough to believe that the teachers taught it wrong anyway, and so they're going to teach it the right way from the beginning. So people just shouldn't worry about it. The other thing that's of significance, you know how people talk about the summer slide in between the end of one school year and the beginning of the next school year, there's this idea that children lose a lot of their academic skills and then have to relearn it. And this has led some people to argue that we should have school all through the summer so that you don't lose those academic skills. You know, my argument is if that's true, well, you're going to lose it as soon as you leave school anyway. Does this mean we should just keep people in school their whole lives because they're going to lose it? And it must mean it was learned in a pretty shallow way to begin with if you're just going to forget it over the summer. The truth of the matter is I've actually looked at the data on summer slide. There actually have been some studies. It's not just word of mouth. There's some studies. And what the studies show is overall there's no summer slide in reading. Reading actually improves over the summer, at least as fast as it improves during the school year. There's a summer slide in arithmetic and math if you are testing it by the standard school methodology of testing. Mm-hmm. So doing school math, you know, like do you remember how to do long division without a calculator? You know, do you remember your timetables? All the kind of stuff that depends on memorizing a method of doing things, memorizing information, that tends to slide, although it's regained very quickly the next year. Mm-hmm. What doesn't slide is mathematical reasoning. And in fact, that increases during the summer. But I found three studies that actually assessed mathematical reasoning, the ability to solve story problems, the ability to make real world use of mathematical concepts. That actually increases over the summer. I found three studies showing that increases at a faster rate than it increases during the school year. And to me, it's not surprising because when you're not in school, you might be doing real things that involve numbers. You're cutting recipes in half, helping your mom cook, or you're measuring boards, or you're painting your room and figuring out how much paint you've got to buy. Or you're playing games that involve numbers, and even computer games. I shouldn't say even computer games, in some sense, especially computer games. Some of them involve rather sophisticated math. You've got to calculate. One unschooling mom told me about her kid who plays this game where he has to calculate compound interest rates in order to figure out how much he's making on his investments in this game. And this is like a 10-year-old kid.
Right.
And he's got to be able to convert between different currencies, know how much he's got if he's spending it in this foreign country or that foreign country. So this is math that is real. This is math that is meaningful to him in the context of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And he's learning these things in a way that he knows what they are, that it's meaningful to him. So this is mathematical reasoning. And so this is mathematics learned in a context in which you're going to remember
exactly it
because it's meaningful. You know what it's for.
Yeah.
So this is the difference. The difference between one of the differences really between self-directed education, whether it's unschooling or at a democratic school, and school at school. So when you're doing school at school, you're learning to pass a test.
Yeah.
And that's all you really care about is passing the test. And you are learning it in a memorized way because you need to feed it back pretty much in the way it was taught to you.
Right.
You're not bothering to think about it. That's just a waste of time.
Right.
Because if you think about it, you might think about it and give it back to the teacher in a way that's different, and the teacher won't understand that and will mark it wrong.
Exactly.
You know, I've seen that over and over again. That drove my son crazy.
My daughter the most.
He was the kid.
Yep.
So, you know, so you learn to be shallow about it. You learn not to think about it. But if you're painting your room and you have to figure out how much paint to buy, well, you better figure out, you know, what square feet really means and how to divide the number of square feet that a gallon of paint will cover by that number of square feet. And now you know what the concept of a square number is. And now you know what multiplication is. And now you know what division is because you've done it in the real world.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it sticks.
It sticks, right.
Yeah, we have one comment and a question from one of our viewers on YouTube. But because you were talking about sleep, and she said, my children have grown taller because they're getting more sleep.
I've heard that from others too.
Really?
I heard somebody wrote in and they told me after 2 months of the lockdown that her son had grown 4 inches or something like that. That might be an exaggeration. Something like it was some amazing amount. I mean, and here's how I believe it. You know, one of the things we know about stress is that it actually does inhibit growth. Stress can produce high levels of cortisone. We know there's actually studies showing that especially young children are producing high levels, stress levels of cortisone when they're going to school.
Right.
And at high enough levels, that can actually inhibit growth. So you can imagine that the relief from that. Now there's kind of a regenerative spurt of growth. I believe it. You know, it'd be interesting to have systematic data on it.
But it would be an interesting study. Exactly. The other question she had, I don't know if you want to answer it or if you want me to field it, but she asked, do unschooled kids have to pass a standardized exam every year in the USA?
No, that's not the case. Now, I have to say that the rules differ from state to state.
Yes, exactly.
But in most states and in most, and even differs in how the rules are enforced from school district to school district. But my experience with homeschooling parents is that generally speaking, there's no requirement to take standardized tests. There's maybe a requirement to report periodically to a school administrator, and usually that report involves some kind of a report that puts into school-like language what your child is doing. And so parents get good at translating what their child is doing into you know, history and geography and mathematics and science, you know. And so in general that, and there are many, many school districts that don't really even check up at all. They're just fine.
Well, and for the states that do require standardized tests, they don't require you turn them in. They are because like in Minnesota, that's a requirement, although they only say if your child falls below the 30th percentile in any subject that you make a change in how you're teaching them in that subject.
I see.
It's very minimal. There are some states like Oregon where you do have to, if your child falls below a certain percentile, you have to develop a plan and submit it to the school district. But it is a state by state thing. So, Most states don't require it. But actually, we have a whole blog on our website about state testing requirements.
Oh,
So
good.
you can look
Good.
for
I'm
that,
sure that's
and
helpful.
that'll be helpful. So, you know, as we have parents thinking about this, do you have any ideas for how parents can increase their child's opportunities for free play and encourage free play learning in their homes? Because we're all stuck in this school mentality. That's how we were all raised. How do we get beyond that and
Right.
kind of open those doors for learning in our homes?
Right. Yeah, so of course right now with COVID, it is largely in your homes. If it were not for COVID, I would be saying, let's not talk about in your homes, let's talk about outdoors.
Exactly. Well, and there is the one exception. If you want to develop a homeschool pod with some families that you have an agreement with, you know, a couple families too.
Yeah, and people are doing that, and there are also ways that kids can play while social distancing. You know, I've seen examples of it. And there are things you can play. I've seen, you know, in the spring, you know, when schools first closed, I'm a big bicyclist and I would go out bicycling and I never saw kids bicycling before. And suddenly I began to see lots of kids bicycling. In fact, in Massachusetts, my state, the bicycle store is all sold out. People were selling used bikes at outrageous prices, you know, because everybody wanted to buy. I saw people teaching their kids, parents teaching their
That's
kids to ride
awesome.
Bikes. I'd never seen that before around here. So then I began to see kids riding bicycles, social distancing while riding. I also saw, you know, some of the old games that I used to play as a kid with my siblings and friends, like badminton. You don't have to get close to one another to play badminton in the lawn, you know. And so there are things that I began to see more. I began to see many more kids outdoors than I had before because they were home from school. And they had free time, and they were bored inside, and they were going out to play. And so, I think that in my mind, the primary requirement for play, the primary resource for play for children is other children, and that is the resource that in our culture today. Not irrespective of COVID, but before COVID, and it's going to be true, and it's true now, and it's going to be true after COVID, that we are a world in which, for the first time in the history of humanity, children don't have easy and free access to other children to play with away from adults. In the history of humanity, children have always spent huge amounts of time playing with other children away from adults. And that's where much of the most important learning occurs. And the reason it occurs is because there's no adults interfering. There's no adults solving the problems. So the kids have to solve the problems themselves. And they learn how to solve the problems. They learn how to initiate their own activity without some adult doing it for them. They learn how to negotiate with their peers so that they can play something they all want to play. They learn how to deal with that bully down the street. You know, what are we going to do about, you know, without some parent solving the problem? They learn how to deal with the realities of the world. That's how children learn how to do it. You know, one of the things that I've often say is that when there's an adult around, children are children. But when there's no adult around, children have to be the adults. Children have to take responsibility. They have to figure out how to do things, and they're pretty good at it. But they need the experience of doing it, and that's why they need lots of opportunity to play away from adults. That's why children, by the age of four, children want to spend at least some time away from adults with other kids. By the time that they're six, seven, eight, and certainly by the time they're teenagers, they want to be away from adults with their friends a lot of the time. And we live in a world where we don't give them that opportunity, and we're stunting their social and emotional, and I would add intellectual development by virtue of not, of creating a world in which that doesn't happen. The only way they can get together with their friends, largely speaking, away from adults is online. And thank goodness they can at least do that. And now there are parents who want to ban them from that, right? So, you know, you take that away and you've really destroyed children's opportunities to interact with other children away from adults.
We put so many limits on it. It was funny that my daughter's friend came over and they were going to take the car and drive across Houston, which is dangerous. And she said, well, what time do you want us back? And I said, well, before curfew, that's fine. And she goes, well, when's curfew? And I said, well, midnight. And she's like, oh, really? I mean, that was like a new concept to her, you know, because I guess her parents had pretty tight rein on her and she was going to stay over at our house. And I said, no, I trust you. And I know in your book you talk about that trustful parenting. Can you delve into that just a little bit?
Yeah. So, I mean, trustful parenting is really recognizing that your child is capable. Mm. You know, your child isn't capable of everything, but your child is capable of a lot more than you might think. And it is trusting your child to have, you know, children have a lot more sense. One way I present this often to parents is think about yourself as a child. And I think most parents, when you think back, you know, what was I like when I was 6 or 7 or 10? Mm-hmm. Or what was I like? What was I thinking? What was I doing? Mm-hmm. And I think that when you really delve into that, you were pretty sophisticated. Mm-hmm. You really were. You know, you might have done some stupid things, but you still do stupid things.
Right? Exactly.
You know, you weren't all that different then than you are now.
Yeah.
You know, some of my research, as you might know, has been looking at how children in hunter-gatherer cultures are treated, mm-hmm. and how they live. And I haven't had the opportunity to study a hunter-gatherer culture directly myself, but I've surveyed anthropologists. Mm-hmm. And what I've learned is that hunter-gatherer cultures, wherever they've studied, they consider children at around the age of 4 to have common sense. And when a child has common sense, then adults don't have to watch them all the time. The child is capable of remembering rules. The child is capable of taking pretty good. The child isn't going to go walking off into the jungle and pet a tiger, you know, or pick up a poisonous snake. The child can remember those things, and the child has enough sense not to do something truly dangerous. That's their assumption. Now, when I was a kid in Minnesota in the 1950s, by the time, I can't say for sure about 4, but by the time I was 5, I could go anywhere in town. I could ride my bicycle anywhere in town. And if I went with my 6-year-old friend who was a bit older and wiser than me, we could go out of town on our bicycle. So there was that, also that sense that, you know, I wasn't going to do something crazy, and nor is your child. But you have to, start off with the assumption that your child has common sense, that your child is capable of these things.
Right.
Another change that's occurred over the years that I've seen, it used to be that, so you recognize that there's dangers out there. You do recognize that there's dangers. And the way that the parents used to deal with that fact is they would teach the children about dangers and how to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
So here's an example, actually, from my own experience, which when I was 4 years old, we were living in Minneapolis, Minnesota, big city. Mm-hmm. We were living in a working class neighborhood on a very busy street, and I remember my grandmother decided, and I would have been 4 years old, I know, because we moved out of Minnesota by the time I was 5, out of Minneapolis by the time I was 5. So I had to have been 4 years old. I remember my grandmother deciding that it was time that I was old enough to be able to go and do some of the shopping myself. To be honest, what she wanted me to do was to be able to go down and buy cigarettes for her. So, this was years ago, right?
Right,
so,
exactly.
So she taught me how to cross the street. She walked with me down to this, you know, this candy and cigarette store.
Mm-hmm.
And she showed me how to cross the street. And we walked back, and then she said, okay, now you're ready to do it yourself. And she sat, and she said, and here's the nickel, you can buy a popsicle and come back. And she sat and watched me on the stoop as I went and I waited for the red, I waited for the walk light, the green light to cross the street. I was being very careful, just as she taught me to be. And I bought the popsicle and walked back. Now, this was a huge achievement. I felt very proud of it.
Yeah.
And then from then on, I could buy cigarettes for her. So, you know, so I'm not promoting buying cigarettes, but I am promoting teaching your children how to cross the street and then letting them cross the street. There are kids who are 10 years old who aren't allowed to cross. It used to be that when by the time you're 10, you could be a traffic guard who was helping younger children cross the street as they walked to school. Now you're not allowed to cross this. Not only are you not a traffic guard, but you're not allowed to cross the street. But, you know, you've got to be driven to school or take a school bus. This is absurd. I mean, we are so underestimating children's abilities. So trustful parenting is recognizing children are much more capable than we think they are, than our culture thinks they are. And to trust your child also is giving your child some important messages. It is telling your child, I believe in you. I believe in your ability. I believe in your morality. I believe you're going to make mistakes, but we all make mistakes, and you'll learn from those mistakes. I believe you will learn from those mistakes.
Yep.
No, that doesn't mean that we're going to give them loaded guns. You know, that's crazy. You know, the hunter-gatherers let the kids play with bows and arrows and sharp knives and fire, because they're not going to kill themselves with that. But the poison darts are kept way away from the little kids, because with that, you'll kill yourself. But we don't make this distinction. We assume, you know, if you could get hurt doing something, then we're not going to let you do it. There are kids who aren't allowed to use the stove at home, or to use a sharp knife to cut their meat, or to, they're truly parents who prevent their child from doing that because they're afraid they might cut themselves. Well, maybe they will cut themselves, or maybe they'll burn themselves, but so what? You know, the body is amazing at healing up, and that's how you learn, right?
You learn very quickly when you do
You
that.
Learn very quickly.
Yeah. That's such a good point, and it does, like you had said, it gives your children the understanding that that you believe in them. And I mean, we can say it to our kids, but they truly don't think we do believe in them until we do take that step back and actually show them we believe in them.
Right, that's right. Yeah. And you need, and you know, the you need to be able to do things in order to prove to yourself that you can do them, whether it's climbing trees, or whether it's, you know, whether it's riding your bicycle around the block and to your friend, or whether it's, you know, all of these things. Children, that's how children grow up. That's the sort of meaning that this nonprofit that I'm involved with, let go and let them grow. That's kind
of
what
that means.
I'm going to put
that up there. It's letgrow.org, right?
Yeah, letgrow.org. That's the whole point of this. Let your kids go. Don't hold on to them all the time. Let them go and let them grow. They need space to grow. They need space away from you to grow.
Yes, so true. And there's a lot of good resources on that website for you to use as a parent to help your kids. And I also wanted to point out your other website for the other nonprofit, the Alliance for Self-Directed Education. That's www.self-directed.org. Can you tell us a little bit about what's on that website?
Well, this is an organization that that's really designed to promote self-directed education, including democratic schooling of all sorts, where the kinds of schools and learning centers that are set up to where children are in charge of their own learning, and the staff members are there just to help if they want help.
Right.
And there's a big community of kids. One advantage of a school or a learning center like that is there's a community of kids. So there's kids who can play with one another, and the staff don't follow them around. The staff don't. So, and also unschoolers very much involved. So there's a resource directory there, a searchable resource directory that where you can find organizations of you can find groups of unschoolers, you can find schools for self-directed education, learning centers, you can find books and articles about it. So that's one of the values of the organization. The organization also has been involved in forming clusters, helping form clusters of people who are involved with unschooling.
Oh, awesome.
So people who you can learn through ASDE about other people who are doing unschooling in your area, if you're an unschooler,
that
you can get together with them. That's often very important, not just for the kids, but it's also often very important for the parents, because one of the major difficulties with unschooling is that not very many people understand it. And so you're constantly having to explain it to people.
Right.
You're constantly on the defensive about it. You're trying to justify it, maybe even to your own parents who believe you're ruining their grandchildren, right? Or they or to your own sisters or brothers or to the neighbors or even the strangers who question what you're doing.
Right,
you
exactly.
know? And it's very hard to do something that runs so much against the cultural norm. And so in order to do that, it's very valuable to be connected with other people who are also doing that, doing what you're doing, and who can share information, who can share ideas, who can, it's nice if you've only got little kids, it's nice to know somebody who's already got a grown unschooler who can tell you, yeah, my kids went through that, and now look, they're doing this and that, and it's reassuring. So you're now part of a community that has a different norm, a different way of talking about kids.
Exactly.
And you're no longer feel like you're such an odd one out, like you're doing this really risky, strange, weird thing that everybody's pointing their fingers at you. At least now there's some people who are with you on this. And that's very helpful. So
need that encouragement. So true. Yeah. And then your book, Free to Learn, can be found on Amazon. And I do highly recommend that. A lot of what Peter has talked about tonight is in there, plus even more to expand on that, because of course 1 hour doesn't give us even close enough time. And then you have a blog also on Psychology Today called Freedom to Learn blog. So if you just go to Psychology Today and search for that, otherwise the URL is up on the screen if you're watching the video. And I saw that you have some blogs with COVID related topics, and then some.
That study that I mentioned that we did through the Let Grow group that's large survey. We actually did it twice. And the results of that, I have two blog posts, relatively recent blog posts that describe the results of that for people who are interested. But there's something like 180 posts there, essays there by now that deal with all kinds of issues regarding play and regarding trustful parenting and ways of finding ways for kids to get together in today's world and really play with other kids. How can that be done in today's world? Or essays on that. So
that's good, because parents have enough things to worry about that sometimes it's nice just to have an expert tell you, how do I do this exactly? And sometimes the nitty gritty day in and day out is what they want to know. So. I just want to thank you, Peter. This has been so insightful, and thank our viewers for joining us as well. Thank for those of you that shared some comments and questions. I know there was one comment from one of our Facebook viewers. She goes, "Let go and let them grow." I hope that's a big takeaway from our hour here. And I just want to thank you again, Peter, for your time just to share with us. And I hope it's encouraged many and maybe caused them to take their toes and just leap off a little bit into the less traditional homeschooling mode, or maybe even if their kids are in the virtual learning world right now, that this might be something that's much needed for them. So,
Okay, well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
And I want to let all of you know that this is just the beginning of this month on teaching methodologies. So next week we are actually going to talk about what are we going to talk about? The Charlotte Mason method with Sonia Schaefer. And so we'll be back again next Tuesday night, same time, 8 o'clock Central, to talk about that methodology as we continue this theme through the month. And also, we just want to thank you for our viewers and the sponsors of Sped Homeschool for providing funds to make this broadcast happen. If you'd like to donate to Sped Homeschool, you can go to our website at spedhomeschool.com and click on donate to continue our supporting our efforts. But we just want to thank you for joining us for this hour, and we'll see you all again next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.